welcome to episode 199E. I mean, 199F. No, wait a minute. 199G? Really? Episode 200 of the Sprocket Podcast.
And I have on my notes from last time that I was trying to pigeonhole you. I'm not trying to pigeonhole you, Aaron. You sir, can be whatever you want to be in this great big world of ours.
Thank you.
So.
Say what he is again.
Brock and Aaron, it's Tim from Pedal Shift. It's been a glorious ride.
Brock is in Germany. Aaron, it's you and me, man.
Yeah, he's given me instructions here. Aptly entitled How to Produce the Sprocket Podcast on our Google Docs. So if any of you want to hack my email.
Hey, Brock and Aaron, this is Todd, the truck driver. Wish you a happy 200th podcast. Hope you guys are all having fun. Wish I could be there. So have fun, have a beer for me, and enjoy yourself.
You enjoy taking the lane, though.
Yeah, well, you know, that's my right.
That's right, yeah. And it is.
Yeah, I got yelled at.
Hey, Brock. Hey, Aaron. This is Johnny K. I love the Sprocket Podcast. It is my favorite podcast. I'm a huge fan. Y'all have a good day. Bye.
Well put, Mr. Rhodes. As the person who inspired me to start recording, you and I sitting down, thank you for the impetus. Thanks for the push to actually do something.
Thanks for doing all the hard work.
Hey, man. Digital heavy lifting is almost like not lifting at all.
A weekly discussion of bikes, trains, transit, and simpler living, live at the Velocult in Portland, Oregon, in the heart of Cascadia. And now your hosts, freak bike lover, a lover of freak bikes, like tall bikes, tandems, bikes with manacles, Brock Davis.
I'm huge!
And craft soda loving and friendless in a crowd. Maybe you should start a zine or a hobby club or something to find people with similar interests. Aaron Flores.
What exactly is Aaron Flores?
Hello and welcome to the Sprocket Podcast, where where we are simplifying the good life. My name is Brock Dennis.
And I'm Aaron Flores, broadcasting from the People's Republic of Portland and still depending on my show notes from the heart of Cascadia.
We are the show that brings you somewhat irreverent conversations about the intricacies of thinking locally with a global perspective and enjoying the very best that life, Portland, Oregon, and Velocult has to offer along the way.
Or Velocult, if you so wish.
If you so choose.
Covering bicycling, trains, and transit, and simpler living. And today, fucking live!
Right you are, my friend. Right you are. It is so good to see everybody out here tonight. Thank you so much for coming out. First of all, show of hands, who is here from Portland, Oregon? There we go.
Go
who
fuck
is
yourself.
Here? That's a compliment here in the Northwest. Who is here from out of state? First of all, Washington State. There we go. We got one, two,
cheaters,
three.
Cheaters.
Other Washingtonians? Anybody else? Who is here from anywhere else that is not Washington State or Oregon State? There we go. That's right. There we go. And you're from California. And you are from...
You are a liar. That's where you are from.
Excellent. I heard rumor that someone from Colorado wanted to come. Are they here?
Colorado in the house.
I don't see Colorado anywhere. All right. Well, maybe they're on their way, or maybe, you know, it's a long ways away. So, anyways, thank you again, everyone, for coming out. It's good to see you. We should give a big thanks, first of all, to Velocult. Everybody give a hand, please. Velocult, of course, is Portland's premier bike shop. We are proud and glad to be here with them. On that note, there is beer for sale in the back of the room over there. Sometimes it's the front of the room. Today it's the back. Well, I don't know. Let's not take sides. There's a bar over there. You can get some beer there or any other beverage that may or may not contain alcohol. There's something for everyone. So please go pick up a beverage, support our gracious hosts, and remember to tip your servers because they're working hard for us. We really appreciate that. Also, let's see, who else do we have here? Sky, because Sky is the guy that owns the place. I don't know if he's here right now, but...
I don't believe he is.
A little little something for my homies. If I had a glass of something, I would pour it out on the ground for him. There we go.
Why are you not drinking anything?
Why am I not drinking something?
Yeah. Someone get this guy a beer.
Is there a chance someone could bring me a beer? I am really not particular. All right.
Eric
in
the back of the room. Oh, look at Adele.
That's a dangerous question, man. Also, thank Eric and the Ride on Fire crew.
Oh, holy.
Can I have you guys?
Why am I censoring myself? Holy shit, guys. Thank you so much.
These guys met up with us at 5:30, and it was an absolutely fantastic ride. We had a good time. Well, we started at LAD, and we came up here. So thank you so much, everyone from the Ride on Fire crew. Really appreciate this.
For my homies.
That's right. And then Aaron Parecki, who's working on the live stream right now. This man.
He's making it happen.
I swear. Buy him a beer. And right now, we had a hell of a time trying to get the audio out to anyone listening outside. So Lillian, back there, also on the tech board, is she's, I believe, at this point, transcribing things for the people in the live chat. So you can just summarize. Just tell them I'm making pretty noise with
mouth. Is there a way to hook up like a steno machine to USB imports?
Oh, that's right. Cool. Well, take your time. Anyways, many thanks to them as well, so give them a hand.
Speaking of Lillian, I think it's worth mentioning Open Road Studios. You might see little handbills on your table there. That is for a podcast network that we are also a part of. Lillian's Transpertinis is a part of it. And Steph Routh hopefully will be, I mean, she is a part of it. Hopefully we'll be having a podcast in the future.
Bike Portland podcast.
Bike Portland. Yes.
Yeah, and many others. I mean, at some point, there will be, probably for every mode of transport, there will be someone doing a podcast about it. So we're very excited about that. Yeah, and there's a studio opener coming up, right?
There is a studio opener October 25th.
Sounds right. Yeah, and that's going to be at the IPRC, where Open Road Studios has its home. So hopefully we'll see you all there. That's on Facebook, and we'll have links to that as well. So, yeah. Also, of note, and I should mention, some of you know we're part of Team Sincerity, our costume this last time around. That's right.
Best fucking day ever.
We dressed up as Mormon missionaries with the sleeves cut off for Bike Scout about over the Labor Day weekend. And so we should note that tonight is the 191st anniversary of Joseph Smith's discovery of the golden plates. That happened today. 191 years ago, according to some. It's your choice whether you believe it or not. I'm on the fence. So, anyways, before we launch into things, Aaron, you're our Twitter master tonight.
Oh, shit. Let me bring that up. Yes, I'm your Twitter master tonight.
Twitter handle is Sprocket Podcast. And instead of having a bunch of people line up or put questions into a box or something like that, if you have questions for any of our guests tonight or questions of any other kind, tweet them to @SprocketPodcast on Twitter, and we will be answering those in the meantime times. So that's it. And also, if you want to text in, I believe Aaron is also our text master.
Correct.
Yeah, so that's 503.
Text us, 503. I was about to rattle my phone number.
847-9774. And you can text those things in as well. So anyways, that's what's up. Aaron, how do you feel?
I realized I'm without pen and paper.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So if somebody would be so kind as to give me a piece of paper and some pens. No, wait. A pen and some piece of papers. Anyways.
Right.
That would be wonderful.
Right.
Yeah. How am I doing? I am scared shitless.
Well, this is a really friendly-looking crowd.
It is. Thank you.
And Sarah Gilbert.
Thank you all for coming out. Oh, my gosh. I honestly thought we'd be speaking to an empty house. Not only did we have such a great ride coming in, but just seeing you all here for this is it's humbling. It's scary. I'm going to look over here for now. But yeah, thank you all for coming tonight.
Definitely. We really appreciate that.
Yeah.
One more technical note. It sounds like there might still be the house music on. If there's a chance we could kill that, that might help our storytellers concentrate a bit more. So thank you again, fellow Cult House staff. Much appreciated. Well, before we invite our storytellers up, there was something I would like to... there's a story I would like to share with you all. And this is something that happened to me a good long while ago. This happened before we started podcasting. This is our 200th episode. It's really hard to believe. We've been appending 199 with letters so many times because, I mean,
it's,
this
it's
is 200.
Probably like 212.
Yeah,
honestly.
Yeah, I think so, probably so. But yeah, it, you know, the podcast has been going for 4 years. This is Aaron's second year as conspiratorial host. Also,
really?
Thanks.
It's been 2 years. Yeah. Oh my God.
Thanks to Brandon Rhodes. Is Brandon Rhodes in the house? I think he was going to make it, but I'm not sure if he's here or not. So, thanks also to Brandon Rhodes for the first 2 years. So, this happened. Let's see, 2009. So, Adele and I—that's my lady friend over there, my wife, my life partner. She's amazing. We've been doing some bicycle touring together for many, many years, and our first big trip was down the west coast of the United States of America. So we went down from the northern border near Canada down to the southern border near Mexico, and we rode all the way along the coastline. And there's a thing that happens when you sleep outside for about 2 weeks and you don't stay inside anywhere, you get used to being outdoors and you do outdoorsy kinds of things like, you know, chopping down wood and making fires and you know, peeing in ditches or something like that. So we had the fine honor of being invited indoors when we went through San Francisco on this trip in 2009. So we were staying with these folks. They gave us the best room in the house. It was a multifamily dwelling, and one of their kind of patriarchs had been living in this room for a while, and he had passed away, but the headboard that he had personally carved was still there. So we're staying kind of like in the room of honor, and it's our wedding anniversary. So Adele and I decided to go out for dinner, as you do. We had a lovely dinner of Thai food, and we were up in kind of the Haight-Ashbury district, and we said, well, what will we do to celebrate? And the obvious answer is buy some really cheap wine. So we walked down the street to a national establishment where we bought some notably famous bottles of $2 wine. At that time, it was $2. Now it's $3. But, you know, it was very cheap, and we thought, hey, we can celebrate without breaking the bank. So we buy two bottles, one white, one red. And we carry them home in paper bags back to this place that we're staying. So we spend all night. We're eating these carrot cake cupcakes. And Adele has, you know, several glasses of wine, which is great for her. But we've got all this wine left over. And I'm like, well, we can't waste it. And we can't take it along. Wine and glass are heavy. So I proceed to drink the rest of the two bottles. So I am, at this point, fully inebriated and ready for bed. So we climb into bed. And we go to sleep. And at some point in the night, I feel the urge of nature. I've been drinking. And so, you know, when you're drinking and when you're under the effect of alcohol, you kind of go to the most natural thing. You go through your habits. So having slept outside for about 2 weeks, most natural thing to do when you have to pee in the middle of the night is you get up and you get out of the tent and then you pee against a tree or something. So I stand up and I take several paces away from the tent. The tent. It's not a tent. I walk into the corner of the room, and I prepare to relieve myself. So Adele notices me walking around, and she says, "Brock, what are you doing?" There's kind of a tinge of fear in her voice, and I say, "I'm peeing in this ditch."
In this here ditch.
In this here ditch. And she looks over at me and says very assertively, "That's not a ditch." And she was right. But once you start, you can't stop. And I'm realizing, midstream, as it were, that this is a bad decision. So we turn on the lights, and it turns out I have filled her waterproof shoes with urine. On the plus side, that means I haven't peed all over the rug of the guest room, the best room in the house. On the negative side, I've just peed into my wife's shoes on our anniversary.
Happy anniversary, honey.
That's right. So at this point, I am fully sobered up upon the realization of what I've done, and I'm thinking, how can I make this up to her? So I spend the rest of the morning, as the sun is coming up, running up and down through these brownstone-style buildings, trying to find their laundry room. I clean out the shoes, I run them through the washer, I run them through the dryer, and bring them out as good as new. And we're still together. I love you.
That ain't love, I don't know what is.
So, anyways, if there's a more to that story, I'm sure you'll find it. Thank you all for coming out again. Let me welcome our first guest, Mr. Dan Christensen. Dan Christensen is a transit driver here in town. I'll let you draw the connections. He has been a guest on our show at least twice, and we are glad to have him back. So a round of applause, please, for Mr. Dan Christensen. He is the author of the Roll Easy blog.
Hello. Hello. Hello.
Hi, guys.
Hey.
Hey, Dan, how's it going?
Just by chance, I wore my I'm Too Cool vest to match. And I noticed I didn't drop the first F-bomb. I love nervous F-bombs.
That's my job, man. Let's make the guests look good.
And I also like that you just asked for a beer and someone brought you a beer. That's so cool. Can I get a Ferrari? And no. And I love the idea of every podcast, every form of transportation getting a podcast. Like someday there'll be like electric golf cart podcast. You know, that'll be great. Okay. So, gas-powered golf carts, they rock. So it's the last day of summer. What better way to send it off than to be here in wonderful Portland in this great place? I love this place. This is like a tribute to human creativity. I love it. And celebrating your 200th episode, that's really great. It's the last day of summer, but we don't fear autumn, do we? No. No. Give us rain. You'll still be out there biking in the rain, right? Wet leaves. Give us cold. You'll still be out there biking. I know. I'd ride by you on my bus all day. See the little blue hands. Right? You'll still be out there. Give us east wind. No. No one likes east wind. So no one likes that. So we'll pass on that one. I'm sure you're wondering why I'm here. Why is this big guy who obviously looks like he hasn't ridden a bike in quite a few years up here? Well, I was invited on there. I blog for Roll Easy blog, which is concerning buses and driving buses in Portland, specifically TriMet. They hate it when I mention that. And so I don't really fit the mold here. I'm a big guy, and I'm almost 50. That doesn't bother me at all. No, I love it. So I write about bus driving. But what I really wanted to do is talk about bikes, because that's why you're here. And it's part of what you say is talking about life beyond cars, and that's really important. And bikes have touched me in a very interesting way in my life. First of all, hold on. Did I mention I'm almost 50? When you get there, they bring you your reading glasses. Thanks, one of us. You see, when you're a bus driver, your job is simple. When I was in training 8 years ago, old Merlot Beat, yeah, when you're a bus driver, your job is to move people. It's real simple. You pick them up here and drop them off there. And I like that. And it works both physically and sort of as a metaphor. My job is to move people. And that happens every day in a lot of little ways. It happens with a smile. It happens when the bicyclist gets the bike off the rack and puts it up and always looks for that little bit of approval from the bus driver. That's right. You did it. But those little things, greeting people when they walk in, saying thanks for riding with me when they leave, all those little ways matter. Bicycles are a little different. You see, in my life, bikes were a freedom. I mean, for a lot of us, the story's the same. When you're on a bike, you're not beholden to any road. You're not constrained by gas. You're not damaging the world we live in. Bikes are life. Bikes are freedom made manifest. They're our first tool we use to explore the world. Mostly trikes and stuff, you're under your parents' management, but your first bike, that's when your world starts opening. And that's when my world started opening. See, you wouldn't know this in the history books, June 12th, 1980, middle of Rose Festival. I'm riding the dreaded Cyclone Ferris wheel. I know. What does this have to do with bikes? You see, it was a great night. The crowds were thin, and I thought, I hate Ferris wheels. It's a good night to take this on. And I climbed up in that ugly beast, and I'm going around. And every time I went around, I noticed everybody's gone. Next time around, I look, and I'm like, they're shutting the lights out for this place. And I get to the top a third time, and we stop. And they start doing that one-step move to take people off the Ferris wheel. And I'm like, what? We just went around three times. What the heck? And I notice it's snowing in June. And I'm like, there's no way it's snowing. This is snow. I can see it for miles in each direction. And I grab some. It's ash. You see, in all the big eruptions of Mount St. Helens, it all went north, and it all went east. But on that night, came south. And so Portland was center stage. The next day I woke up, and our wonderful green city had turned to gray. And I hopped on my giant, ugly, suburban, brown Schwinn bike and started pedaling. And I was lucky. My dad had a construction company. I got a mask and goggles, so I looked like the biggest doof in the world, this little kid on this giant Schwinn bike that's built for a grandpa, shooting down Sandy, going all over and seeing this crazy world. Our city changed. And seeing things that I've never seen before. Seeing a car go down the street with a towering column of ash chasing after it. There wasn't many people driving, and I may have been involved in the climbing up on the 57th and Sandy statue and putting a dust mask on the statue. It's only rumor. So you can be at the center of everything on a bike, and you will see the world much differently than passing by it in a car. You'll experience. You'll taste that ash in your mouth, literally. I remember my mom saying, you know, be home, head home when the streetlights come on. And I don't know, countless summer nights, I split the air biking like hell to get home. And I just remember that feeling. And it's a great memory of my mom. Little things like that matter. I learned from my bike many things. Little things that might not come up very often. Like if you're in the United Kingdom and you're biking through Wales and you go 27 miles, but it's only 5 miles on the map, you go, these hills are killing me. I should hitchhike at a truck stop. So you learn where you can get help on a bike. Because the trucker's there, throw their bike on, and away you go. I've seen the world change from a bike when I biked along the Berlin Wall that they told us would never come down in 1990. And I got to see East Germany from a bike. I learned the power of physics on a bike. The relentless and evil power of physics. As my friend Marcy Lopez and I figured a way to jury-rig a mast and a sail made from a drop cloth for painting. And we were excited by the 35-mile-an-hour gust winds that were coming out of the east, and we were going, yeah! And then we learned that stopping was not so easy. I learned that when you take off on a bike, even if you're hit by a terrible rainstorm, see, we didn't have cell phones. Things snuck up on us. And you're drenched from head to toe. And you arrive at a party that other people didn't drive to in a car because it was raining. You're living epic. I learned that a bike can touch others. When I was visiting Seattle in the 90s, there was a horrible snowstorm. Just terrible. And it was the day before Christmas. Actually, it was Christmas Day when we woke up. and I walked outside, and this house down the street had burned down. And luckily, the family had went next door, because that was their grandparents. And the whole neighborhood was there gathered around, looking at this destroyed house. And there was the father on his knees on the ice, trying to put together a little toughy bike with that little universal tool. And his hands were shaking, and there were tears in his eyes. And me and about three other people said, hey, we'll do this. And we shooed him back in the house, and we sat there and put together that godforsaken toughy bike with that little piece of tin, and then we took it in there. And it was the only present to survive because it was in the car. And I realized when I saw that kid, I'm like, this bike just touched this kid. This means something. And after my divorce, when I was as low in my life as I could possibly be, I would bike to my daughter's, to my ex-wife's house, and hide my bike in the cemetery across the street and lock it up because I could only afford one bus ticket. So I'd pick up my daughter and pay to go home. And then come back 2 days later and hope my bike was there. Somehow nobody wanted my Schwinn Suburban. Not a single person. Thank you. I agree. I learned compassion from a bike. When I was young and biking along and I saw a dog that had been hit by a car and the car was gone, there was nothing I could do. Again, no cell phones. What can you do? So I sat there with the dog while it passed away. It was about 40 minutes. And I took the collar, and I just didn't want, I took the collar, took it to the house, dropped it off, and told them where the dog was. But I didn't want the dog to die alone. And that really touched me. And I learned embarrassment. When I took teenage years, and I had a walking date, going over to my girlfriend's house, soon to be girlfriend, I thought, we'll call her Magic Blue Eyes. So I went over to Magic Blue Eyes and I thought, oh my God, I can't pull up in this brown piece of crap bike. So I went around the block and I locked it up and I walked around, knocked on the door. Hey, you want to go for a walk? Everything's great. And we're walking. She goes, hey, let's go to my grandfather's house. Okay. You don't say no to Magic Blue Eyes. So we're walking along and we turn right and I go, And we walk and we turn right again and I'm like, oh crap, there's my bike. And then we get up there and she kind of looks at my really badly, bad shaped bike and goes, psh, what's that? And I go, I have no idea. And then right at the bike, she turns right to her grandfather's house. The old guy who was out watering his lawn, who's sitting on the porch. And I looked, and I went, this isn't going to go good. And he says, why did you park your bike here? No more dates. I've learned from bikes giving. And in my life, I've had bikes. I've never sold one. I've always given them to someone who needed them. Every bike I've owned, I've given. And 7 times that's happened. There's someone here tonight who I've given a bike to. We're getting close to the end. One of my favorite stories is biking across England and getting to the east side of London and going, oh, I can't go anymore. Crossing London at night in a bike in the 90s was death. And I'm like, there's no way. I'm so tired. This isn't going to happen. Let's take the train. So we go over to the train. Oh, yeah, the great rail system of on strike. And we're standing there. And just like here, when the MAX train breaks down, they have buses. There's these double-decker buses. And we go, hey, that's great. We'll just go get on a bus. So we hop over there. No, No bikes on a bus. And they were, we begged. We were so exhausted. We begged them. So we were sitting inside, just can't figure out what to do. And this guy walks up with a yellow shirt on and clipboard. He goes, "What's going on?" I'm not even going to fake an English accent. "What's going on?" And I say, "Well, we're broke down," and we go through the whole story. And he goes, "Okay, get in that bus." And we go get in the bus. He walks up, gives somebody a clipboard, grabs a radio, comes back, and starts driving us all the way across London. And every time we would pass a train stop, everybody there would go at this driver. And I'm like, is this guy in the movies? What the hell? This was the head man of the bus drivers. He just thought that day he would move people, just like I do. And I've thought of that every day that I've got behind the wheel. That those little things can make a big difference. You know, so what does this all mean? Well, I'll tell you. It could mean by the time you're 50, you have a lot of stories. But it's more than that. You see, when I drive a bus, I move people. But when I ride a bike, the world moves me.
Thank you, Dan. Wow.
Thank you, Dan. Before you go, I believe, well, hang on, let me do this.
Is this where I get a prize?
This is where you get the prize, yes.
It's a brand new bike!
It's a Schwinn Suburban.
Ow.
Hey, we got mail.
So, yes, questions and things that have been texted to us
questions
by Twitter.
Questions and things.
Or text.
Actually, before we go to questions, or questions singular, I want to introduce you all to a little game that has been played unbeknownst to us throughout at least since
summer. Oh, yes, that's right.
Apparently, there's a Sprocket Podcast drinking game going on. And so some of you know what this is. Apparently, a lot of you don't. But I'll let you in on this. So apparently, we who are into simple living and not necessarily cluttering our lives with items and products, apparently we mention a lot of products on our show.
We do indeed.
So it may be more of a comment on the pervasiveness of capitalism, but I'll let you leave that up to interpretation. Anyways, the drinking game goes like this, and thank you, Krista, in the back for inventing this.
That's it, yeah.
Anytime we mention a product on the show, you already yell drink, and then, of course, take a drink.
There we go.
It's that easy, folks.
So, for example,
Ford Motor Company. Get those drinks.
And
in
how? Schwalbe Marathon Tires. I like them. Three questions for Dan Christensen.
Anyone? Actually, this is a question singular for us.
Oh, there we go. Okay.
And I'm almost embarrassed to say this, but since it was Rob Sadowski who tweeted this to us,
okay.
Rob Sadowski over here.
Right.
Right over here. He brought the sausages, by the way.
He did bring the sausage.
He asks us, Sprocket Podcast, what reminds you of your first time? And I'm assuming he means on a bike.
Well, that's open to interpretation.
That's true. I'm just going to say hummus. Wonderful, wonderful hummus.
There we go. For me, boy, like being 5 years old and on a beautiful multi-use trail. Riding
a
bicycle.
Multi-use trail.
It was lovely. I'm just taking the most literal interpretation of that question, and probably the safest.
Also, yeah. Planters peanuts.
Oh, yes, right. All right. Do we have questions for Dan specifically?
We do not.
Okay.
Oh, I see. I need to tweet that live stream. Come back. I need to...
Technology is so difficult. It really is. And this
is a sign of my
seemingly
age,
this is a show about simplicity, right? What? Oh, sure. Dan wants to ask us a question. In that case, yes. All right. So roll easy, Dan.
When you first started, What was the most episodes you think you'd ever get done?
When we first started, how many episodes? Well, I knew there were at least three because we pre-recorded three before Brandon and I started.
Oh, well, when you first, I thought he was asking me when I first started. That's fine. Was like doing one, and then you'd go like, Aaron, we need to talk.
Bye. Okay, so one and done. Okay. No, somebody asked me this on the bike ride over here as we were riding with the grill bikes, and I never thought we'd get to two. I never thought you all would be here, and I'm very happy to see you all.
Awesome.
Can of tubes. Drink. Thank you, Dan. Thank you so much for sharing that. That's a lovely legacy of a life history with bicycles, and I think we're all better for hearing it, so thank you so much. Again, a hand for Dan Christensen, everybody. All right, next up, Sarah Gilbert. What was that? Oh, YouTube says we're looking sharp. Okay. Hey,
thank you, YouTube.
YouTube's full of shit.
What are you doing Friday?
Shh, this could be the only time I have a date. Too,
yeah. YouTube, what's up?
This is Sarah Gilbert. She is a bikey mom. Did you edit, or your magazine is basically yours, right?
Yes.
Stealing Time Magazine. Mm-hmm. A literary journal for guide? No.
Journal for parents.
I'm sorry.
It's sort of on hiatus right now.
There we go. Okay.
It will come back.
Excellent.
I hope.
And also a leader of bicycle tours in and around the Portland area. So a big hand for Sarah Gilbert, everybody.
I've never thought about my bike like many do, how many grams or even pounds it weighs, how to lighten the load. The opposite, in fact, is true. I bought my bike in 2008. I bought my bike in 2008 with my tax stimulus check. I bought my bike to carry my kids. Almost six, just 3, 9 months, that's how old they were then. I bought my bike. It was a beautiful bike. Still is. A townie plus extra cycle with a longboard style back and a seat between the handlebars. I bought it to carry my kids. They needed to be carried then. My oldest wouldn't get a bike until his 6th birthday, and even then, a 6-year-old needs to be carried. I would carry them everywhere, to school, to the buying club to get boxes of blueberries, to the farmer's market, to the knitting tea shop. There is something about carrying someone you love on the back of your bike. There's a closeness, a sense of touch, a power. My boys fit into it naturally. Monroe, between the handlebars, falling asleep on my gear-shifting arm so I'd have to ride in third gear everywhere. I tell people now, Monroe needed all the touch I could give him. When he was 2, I stopped knitting almost altogether. He needed all my space. He needed those countless hours, those countless miles between my handlebars. My oldest, Everett, needed it too. He needed someone to rely on, needed someone who could take up his weight and pedal, putting him down only on the sidewalks on the steepest hills to walk. His dad was uneven. All my boys have diagnoses, and one of Everett's is oppositional defiant disorder. He reacts to the expression of dominance with extreme stress, without fighting back. But on my bike, he was riding under his own invitation, under my invitation, under his own might. On my bike, time slowed down, or maybe it was the hurry was made to cease. The boy's movements counterbalanced mine, and Everett had more control in yielding to me than in fighting back. So over time, he learned to yield on his own. I too had to balance my own body, my own mind at first, the physical stress of managing the constantly shifting weight, the emotional stress, what if I drop them? I had to develop a sense of both my own body and how it worked with the boys. I had to develop a sense of my own strength that at first was just attention and then slowly became more, a sense of reverence, a sense of awe. All my nerves are firing with my boys on my bike, listening for the traffic, feeling the constantly moving bodies of the boys behind me, the sensing my muscles reacting almost without thought. Time to get off the bike and walk. Everett would encourage Truman, my middle son, to run up the hill too. Truman, whose silence on the back of my bike was okay. He'd thread his arms through the back of my shirt sometimes just to feel his skin against mine. everything was okay on the back of my bike. My boys could submit to me, and I could carry them. We could stop for trash, for treasures and tantrums, and for me to look at Truman in the eyes to see if he'd heard me. They talk about modeling as a parent, but I think riding with your kids on the back of your bike is the most intensive sort of modeling that you can have. They almost had to follow my eyes wherever they went. A sunset, an apple tree, a hawk, the light on the spectacular clouds. My boys at almost six, just 3, 9 months were hard, and it would be many years before they would get easier, and I credit so much of it to my bike. They got bigger. As years went on, they got onto their own bikes one by two. They stopped going everywhere with me. Big now, independent, powerful. Still, I carried things, groceries, free pile furniture, boxes of fruit. So I carried them sometimes. Monroe, he'd run out of energy or patience, and I'd have to pick him up slumped over his handlebars on the side of the road, his bike too, and carry him home. On the crazy days, it would be him, his bike, and the free pile furniture all together. It was so heavy, but it made me feel so powerful. A year ago, I changed things, asked for a divorce, began the excruciating process of parenting in two households. My boys rode more on my bike. I'd have to pick them up sometimes from their dad's house. They'd leave their bikes at my house most times, and I'd have to carry them back up the hill. But the worst was when I'd go home without them, so empty, so light. When I was changing things, I fell in love. My new love, the thing that he said that started it all was, "You're so full of life and passion, and can you pick me up on your bike?" I don't know what it was that fueled the passion that we had, but maybe it was his seeing me, his loving the life in me, that looking in each other's eyes over a cafe table, or the weight of him on the back of my bike, the succumbing to power, the yielding to power, the wielding that weight. I took him home and I took him out. I took him to dinners and parties and strip clubs. When I'd stop at lights or just on the side of the road, I'd turn around and kiss him. He'd put his hand up the back of my back. Real love. One day, I took all of his things to my house, and mine, 9 loads up the hill, I told him, "This is my hero's quest." He said, "Yes." He said, "You are my one true love." I'll skip to the end. I can't tell the rest of that story now. He took his things back. And in the weeks that followed, I started this job as a bike tour guide months ago. My legs were strong, my arms were brown, my hair blonde. I felt so empty, so light. To fix this, I tried to do everything I could think of. I rode on the back of other people's bikes. I didn't like that. I was scared. I liked to be in control. I tried feats of strength, bike camping, and carrying all of our stuff 20 miles in, all the wood too, over the hills. I woke up at 4 a.m., rode over the Terwilliger Hills, 40 miles to go wine tasting. I carried my other friends, new loves, maybe on the back of my bike. But when they got off, I wasn't soothed anymore. I would go home alone, powerless, maybe. No, all those years and all those miles on the back with my loves on the back of my bike, and I hope what I did, even if they're away from me for a little while, forever, what I did was give them something, my faith, my strength, my power. I still have my power, my arms, my legs, my lungs, my heart. I have my power to wield however I want to. I still have my power.
Thank you, Sarah. I always love a good tale of empowerment. Thank you.
There's something of beat poetry in there.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Yeah. Aaron, what from the internet?
Tweet, 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 tweet. Zilch. However, I will read this. I will read this comment from Dan Christensen here to Lily. Well, first I'll read Lily's comment, and that is... Whoops. Yes. Schwinn Suburbans are great here at Velocult.
Yes, they are.
Schwinn Suburbans. Schwinn Suburban.
Schwinn Suburban. A toast. Oh, yes, and drink.
And Dan Christensen replies, if you like Schwinn Suburbans, you are great.
Perfect, perfect. Excellent. How's everybody
Come
doing
on,
out
I'm
there?
Trying to engage you here.
Anybody need a drink? If you do, there is a bar back there. Again, you can Twitter to us while we're doing this at Sprocket Podcast. The SMS is 503-847-9774. And we also have another storyteller that we'll bring up. Mr. Joe Kermaski, the Metal Cowboy, from themetalcowboy.com. And I should share before Joe begins that, Joe, you were actually the inspiration, as I'm sure you've heard from many people, for us to start bicycle touring. When Adele found your book, she read it, she got me into it. So, Mr. Cowboy, thank you. We appreciate that.
Hey, I have three books. Drink three times. Right now. Okay, I'm Joe Kermaski, a.k.a. the Metal Cowboy. I don't look like much of one. Look more like an aging surfer. Where's my haiku shirt on my chest? I have to tell you guys, I just come from the sands playing to 5,000 bike-loving fans. It was awesome. Like a rock star. And I get this email from these two. So I agreed to this podcast. They said, hey, come on out. It'll be a blast. I'm on this high. I bike out there. And... I had just performed this piece about an ode to being uncomfortable, about ending the days sweaty and bloody and greasy and not hermetically sealed into your own lives, about riding until your teeth bleed and your chest feels like rust. End those days miserable and wet and cold and hungry. And I rode out to this gravel little corner in East Portland. Was raining on me, and I thought, Jesus, this wasn't what I meant. And they pulled up. I think you guys had gotten dinner or something. You pulled up after I arrived, and I thought, I'm getting rolled. I mean, I've been across India. We're going down into this basement. It really conjured up that moment when I was in Copper Canyon on a bicycle in light weather gear, because I did not understand that Mexico in the wintertime is not Acapulco. So I'm in Copper Canyon, light jacket, freezing my ass off, looking for the Tahamari Indians. I'd met that guy, the Born to Run guy, earlier in the year. This was back in the early 90s. And he told me, come on down for the Easter festivals. They incorporated Christianity. They were smart. They came down, and when the Spanish came to cut their hands off, they handed them fruit, took their Fatimas, and ran back up into the canyons. Nobody found them for fucking 200 years. And if they did, they had the old Matinas standing right there, the Fatimas, the statues of Christ. They didn't care. They did their own thing. So I wanted to see this, and it was just like pulling up to your house.
Thank you.
Pulling up to these guys with machine guns in a Jeep. And they looked me down, and I looked at them, and I said, Viva la Zapatista! Now I'm 800 miles north of any Zapatistas. And these guys with the machine guns just started laughing their asses off, put the bike in the back of the Jeep, and drove me, ostensibly, to the Tahamari Indians. Now, this is where I agree to crazy shit, and this is the thing I did. I agreed to this podcast the same way I agreed to get into a Jeep with guys that spoke very little English and machine guns driving me deep into the canyons of Mexico. It could have ended poorly. as could this podcast have ended poorly. But it turned out, like many things in my life, that big, hulking St. Bernard approach to life, go out, be uncomfortable, take risks, live dangerously, and have a life. Because in the end, we're all, whether we write it down like Hunter S. Thompson's suicide note or not, which said three words, no more fun. Well, it's the last day of summer. Let's continue into the fall to have that fun, because we're all going someday. So I went to the podcast. I had a hell of a good time. And I don't even know which podcast it was or what a podcast was at the time.
Number 20.
Number 20. Lucky number 20. So one little bit before I dive into I Was the Rosie Rez of STP. I got to cycle. For my job, I got to cycle northern Italy this summer. Saying that out loud makes me sound like a complete asshole. I got to cycle northern Italy for my job. Come on. For my job. That was a smug comment to a room full of people who didn't get to cycle Italy. How many people cycle Italy this summer for their job? Northern Italy. Well, if heaven is not offering me croissants the size of a baseball mitt and beautiful women dressed to the nines to serve you pizza, Italian women, I love the, that's why I married a beautiful Tuscany woman in the United States. But if Italy is not like this, if it doesn't have women that, when they announce at the Colosseum, when we were watching Aida, they announced the rain poured in on us and we all had to go down to the catacombs for like the second time and wait it out because $100,000 instruments are pervious to rain. So we're down in the catacombs, like 2,000 of us, beautiful. Oh, these beautiful, arrogant, dangerous creatures in like 6-inch tall stilettos, smoking cigarettes, and they announce in three languages, please do not smoke in the catacombs. And every time it came through in Italian, I would see the Italian woman go, and those women, I looked out and it looked like, you know, it might be my unlucky night. We might have to battle the lions in the Colosseum that evening. And I was going to get behind one of those dangerous women. Because you know they just take off that stiletto, put the cigarette out in the lion's eye, and just slice the throat of that thing and just walk across elegantly to the other side. I'm going to work my way right behind her. At any rate, Northern Italy was fantastic, and I got to cycle with this guy. He was named Outside Magazine's top tour guide of Europe, which Marcello just went like this. When he was told that, he went, it's bullshit. This guy was a Renaissance man. He would sing opera as he would drive along. He played a 12-string guitar. He sounded just like Sting at 3 o'clock in the morning. Bring on the night. Oh, it was just a... He was an ex-road racer. He never had... He encouraged everybody. And this tour was something I've never... I carry lightsabers and 500 pounds of kids and diapers and gear. And we have 4 sons because we're not Catholic, just careless. And I have to carry all these kids all that way. And here we are, Marcello and I got a lock and a front bag and some juice. And it was like Pegasus had given me, I was winged. I was just flying along. And oh my God, he came up by me and we were in the Dolomites. And I really worried about this trip. For about 3 minutes, I worried, I've only been pedaling a cargo bike all winter. I got to keep up with these folks. It turned out that I would sit in the saddle up the Dolomites and they'd be all hammering alongside, trying to keep up with me, and I'd say, come back down here. Oh, the air is thicker down here. You'll breathe better. It's good. So we pedal along, and Marcello, he would laugh because all the people's disposable income, massages, 5-star meals, the anti-tour. I've never done a tour like this before. And people brought in like 3-hour tours, Thurston Howell amounts of luggage. I brought a bug backpack for 2 weeks in Italy. And at that point, Marcello said, now everybody drops their day packs over here in the morning and the other luggage over here, except Joe, because that's all he brought. He has a day pack, so he'll be fine. He can get his stuff anytime. So we're pedaling along one day, and God, these are salt-of-the-earth people, but incredible disposable income and an arrogance that is just, it's a bumbling arrogance, I hope. And at one point, his name was Steve Irwin. He hadn't come back from the dead. It was Steve Irwin. And he was talking about his $100 million yacht that he had to sell because it was just too many people, too much overhead. And he turns to Marcello as we're riding along. And Marcello and I have been talking about Cheap Trick and about our Tuscany brides. And he's singing Italian opera again. And Steve pedals up and he says, "Ah, Marcello, with all of your talents, you could be making so much more money." Now, I would have pimp slapped the guy at that point. But Marcello, this buoyant, gregarious, being paid by the tour guide, turns and smiles and he just uproariously just laughs and says, "Ha, but Steve, you haven't heard. The pawn and the king go back in the same box at the end of the game." Fuck yeah, Marcello. Surrender, but don't give yourself away. All right, that's actually not the story I wanted to tell tonight, so we'll put that aside. Let's pretend that was the opening act. I want to tell you guys how I became the Rosie Ruiz of STP. Anybody want to tell me who Rosie Ruiz was? Anybody got a history? Anybody old enough? Ah, let's got it here. Marathoner. Before the tragedies of the Boston Marathon, there was a smaller fraud that was perpetrated. And this was Rosie Ruiz. I sympathized with her after this story when I was the Rosie Ruiz of STP. But what happened was she was on her way to the starting line, but Boston. Have you ever tried to drive in Boston? For fuck's sake. Oh, my God. Can you blame her? She got in a cab, I'm sure. Communication issues, traffic. She ended up running out from under an underpass at mile 22 of the race she was supposed to be in. So she finished ahead of all of the women and many of the men. And for about 20 minutes, it was the miracle on ice, not on ice story. They crowned her, the snapshots, it was amazing. And then they realized Rosie hadn't passed any but two of the checkpoints. That crown became thorns, and she lives in infamy. But I believe it was just a mistake. The same way what happened to me, I have ridden the Seattle to Portland bicycle ride, just not in the year this story takes place. You see, you got two types of riders on that STP. You got what I call the Chinese New Year's riders. They look like a dragon. They're all the colored spandex. They all leave, and it's just a swirling train of cyclists. Some of them are wearing their vintage postal jersey kit. And they are going to make this in one day. Because they believe, sincerely, they believe there is a yellow jersey waiting for them at the end. That they don't have to buy it at the gift shop in Paris like the rest of us mortals. And if you're going to wear a postal jersey, for Christ's sake, either bring me my mail or be faster than me. I did it in 2 days. Same way I did in Africa. I dropped back and rode with the game viewers crew. Those are my people. The people that want to be on the road, on the bicycle from sunrise to sunset and take in every rhino, every giraffe, every watering hole. And I had a counterpart in Africa named Dave. He wrote for the Outside Magazine of Africa. And we were sitting in a watering hole. We both dropped back from the first group that just had their heads down the other guy's asshole, just sort of riding straight ahead. 5 minutes for tea. Back on the bike. Mow, mow. We were back with the game viewers, and there goes team number one, flew right by us, and we're sitting there naked and 20 of us, game viewers, giraffes, and hingas, just beautiful. And a little tinge of me said, Dave. He said, ah, don't worry about it. They're not in first place. And I thought, oh, he's getting philosophical on me. He said, no, they took the wrong Karen. They're way the fuck out there. They didn't look up, so we're ahead of them right now for the next hour or two until somebody realizes. So I take my time when I did SDP, but not this amount of time, like 3 years. What happened was I was invited to be the Bob Hope of the closing party when they held it at Cathedral Park down at in St. John's. That would be the end of the ride party. And here I am, getting all my books, 300 pounds of books and chariot trailer, and oh my goodness, this thing, the trailer, the trailer bike, the tandem, my boys put on their risky business glasses. It was a 5 mountain peak day. Oh, you know those days in July. And we had just finished a 4th of July parade on that rig, on that 15-foot rig. And so we had that thing decked out like an eco-friendly refugee from a gay pride parade. Oh, I mean, this thing had pink and purple streamers. It had Roman candles. Oh, it was just a sight to see. It was not low profile. It turns out that I have a house on Willamette Boulevard about a mile and a half from Cathedral Park, right there near Adidas. And I have to tell you guys, 1.5 miles, even pulling 3 kids and panniers and gear and 200 pounds of books and my posters, and you cannot break a sweat 1.5 miles on flat ground along the bluff. But you can get caught by 5,000 of your closest STP friends coming down the last hill up to the final rise. I got caught like a salmon in the stream. I tried to turn out. They wouldn't let me. They gave me respect. Oh, they gave me respect. But they wouldn't let me back out. Oh, there were people pushing each other aside, getting a better look. There were veterans saluting us. There were PTA moms with their hands on their hearts. We got to the top of the last hill, and as we crested it, I shit you not, Chariots of Fire music playing. The hippie drums started, and that one non-native Native American actor from the 1970 commercial standing off to the side with a tear running down his face. Little sidebar, it was a tattoo, but he was there. And as I crest the top, I could see relatives, deserving relatives, getting pushed out of the way so they could get a better look at this thing. And we got a good head of steam coming down. And something happens in the crowd ahead of me. Something has happened. They just start cheering and pointing at me. And when I look back, Enzo, after his 3,000-mile ride across America, has really learned how to detach himself from the 5-point safety harness of that chariot. He has thrown it open, and he was holding it with one hand and waving with the other. It's turning into a de facto Pope mobile. Oh, and she's been dead for years, but he's got the Princess Di waved out. And as we head into the crowd, Quinn hops up on the trailer bike and just stands like doing some kind of Dr. Seuss Whoville shit. Down, boys, low profile, low profile. People swarm us. They're selling us dry flowers and chiclets and speaking in different languages. And here comes the director. And he's running at me, and he's got a medal. And this is about to go this is about to go bad. Bad. And I do the only thing I can do. I run up to him, and I embrace him in a bear hug and give him some Italian air kisses because he can't put a medal on me while I'm gripping him. And at that moment, I have an Evel Knievel helmet, so he's just getting me back. At that moment, I whisper, not unkindly, into his ear. I say, I have not just pedaled from Seattle, Washington. He puts me at arm's length. He looks me dead in the eye. His lip quivers a little. And he announces, it's okay if it took you 2 days. At that moment, the crowd, just a mob scene now. They are surrounding. I've realized over the years, I started out optimistic, went jaundiced, and then it's just sublime and absurd now. And at that point, I realized when a mob, jubilant or vicious, is faced with the truth or the show, they're going to take the show every time. There was no coming back. So I rolled that contraption behind the stage, and I tried to put what I refer to as the episode behind us. And just as I started to feel a little centered, I was raised, I'm a fallen away Catholic with Buddhist tendencies. So in any given situation, I am blanketed by guilt. But it always ends with a river of peace. So I was finding my river at that moment. When, I don't know if you guys remember from Fox News, she's moved on, but Kelly Day was wandering around with her cameraman, and she was looking, she was at that desperate moment in the media that they have to find a story, anything. Oh my God, it's the Metal Cowboy. I'd been on her show 2 or 3 times. She spots me, duck and cover, can't get it. She, oh, this is great, look at those medals. Quinn, by the way, accepted his medal. He stood up on the trailer bike, proudest son of a bitch on the planet at that. He figured, I've been 8,000 miles on this damn bike with my dad. Jedi warrioring, damsel in distressing. Yeah, give me a medal. So he's got a medal on. Kelly Day's got the camera on. I should have broken down to a cold sweat and confessed my sins to the greater metropolitan regional viewing public. But when I saw that green light, I channeled my inner Bill Clinton. Oh, I knew what his was, always would be. Oh, I felt good. I felt solid. And when that light went on, Alan Kelly, oh, she nailed it. She nailed it. Pan that camera across, all of that kids and gear and the metal, and put them up on your shoulders in 3, 2, 1. How does it feel, cowboy, to have peddled all this precious cargo all that way? Oh, I looked right at the camera. I may have winked. I know I smiled. And what I said next, while technically not a lie, I'll tell you, Kelly, feels like I just left my doorstep 10 minutes ago. You got to take a knee when you've told one that bold. Now, if that was it, I could live with myself. But when I got home, I thought, this is a good teaching moment for my children. I put on Warren Zevon's Lawyer's Gun to the Money, and I broke out a Wikipedia, and I said, boys, come here. I said, let's define the word fraud together. They got it right away. They said, oh, Dad, it's like playing make-believe. And I said, yeah, yeah. But if as an adult you play make-believe too much of the time, you have 2 career choices. License plate maker or Sarah Palin website blogcast woman. I felt good. I felt I'd taught some valuable lessons. And then I realized at that moment that the only confessor that mattered, the only person in my life that did not need to see this, was tucked in bed with the clicker right beside her. Oh, I broke out. I do not like to run. That's why I cycle. Is your bike broken, I tell runners? I sprinted down to that bedroom. I slid through the pulled up short. And God love her. She had a Thomas Pynchon the size of War and Peace in her hand. Clicker way off to the other side of the bed. I palmed that son of a bitch, slipped it under the mattress, and realized, like no other point in my marriage, I had wed so, so far above my station. She doesn't know still to this day, so shut up about it. I have one more story, and I brought my trumpet today. You guys, can I indulge you with one more story? Oh, you didn't know there was a song. There's dinner and a show, motherfuckers. So, there are worse instruments to bring along on a bike tour, but not many. Stand-up bass comes to mind. Accordion. These are annoying instruments, but just one notch above bringing a trumpet all the way down the west coast of America. And I did it. Your ukulele, your harmonica, even your banjo is a better call. There is at no point on 3,000 miles of touring with my trumpet did I get somebody saying, hey, you know what we need right now with these Jack Johnson tunes? We could really use that guy over there to hit us with a Curtis Mayfield. It never happened. The only people that seemed to appreciate my trumpet playing on tour were the Coyotes. But I'm going to tell you the story, and it's we all have, as you get older, if you're lucky enough to get older, you lose people. And I lost somebody on Saturday, and I want to devote and give this story up to him. When the Saints go marching in, I want to be in that number. I want to be in the rear, on the bicycle, playing the shit out of that song. And I'm the guy, you'll spot him, because I'm just got that shit-eating grin during the drum breaks. And I'm Josie Will in this bad boy, like a six-shooter. And I'm fist-pumping to that voodoo beat with the other hand. You see, this rent-to-own little cornet from Don Banks Music in Florida. Thank you. Place has been out of business for 25 years, but I think any excuse. Hey, my books are on sale, too, after the show. Metal Cowboy. So, one week into junior high, I took up the horn. And it was like my secret garden. The minute I put my lips and blew a note, a light shifted inside my head. And I found my way through the thickets to this speakeasy in the Florida backwoods. Just dirt floor, tin roof, a little makeshift stage of milk crates. And who's drinking and easy laughing at the bar but Baker, Albert, Miles, Gillespie, the baddest ass River Cats, black, Cuban, and Mexican horn section of the millennium. To get there, I dropped the needle on my dad's collection, put those headphones in his darkened study, and I was there. And when I came out on the other end of my teen years, I was fairly unscathed. Did I still represent a wet, hot mess of Adam's apple, feathered platinum blonde hair, and questionably patterned terry cloth shirts in 1978? Yes. But it saved me. It was like coming home. When I was able to make music, even though it was like the theme to Rocky and Hawaii Five-O, and I was bad at first, but I got this roughneck flair eventually. And it was all because of Mr. James Dale Crosby. This guy was a wonderfully strange bird. And if you ever have been in a band or a band practice or any kind of music instructor in school, you'll know they are all strange birds. But this guy, aside from actually looking like a bird, he had a pointy nose, a pinched face, big owl glasses, and not one, but two, the whole back was hunched. He was a hunchback with a small European sports car that no longer went in reverse. So Dale, as I like to call him, he had everybody call him Crosby, Dale would circle like a vulture. He did look a little like a vulture. He'd circle the block every morning, playing his Led Zeppelin, his Jethro Tull, and his Blood, Sweat, and Tears, looking for a big enough space where he could nose in. He did not come in stealth in his life. And that continued out on the playground. During recess, the monkey bars were right in the middle of the action. And this bold motherfucker, he would get up on the monkey bars and do behind-the-back chin-ups with his hunch, because you cannot do front chin-ups when you have a hunch that big. And this would stop four square games at first and people reading good books, and they'd all stare. And you know what Jim Dale Crosby did about that? Didn't let it bother his routine in the least. And because he didn't let it bother him, it became a forgotten piece of the landscape. He lived every situation like that. It didn't fucking matter, so it didn't fucking matter. And besides teaching me how to play a trumpet, he gave me that nugget. Pull your collar up and play your own game. And he has no idea how far that has taken me in my life. One day, Jim pulled me aside about 3 months into learning the trumpet. I was in no way ready for what he was about to offer me. He said, Joe, you will report to the office 5 minutes before the start of class and 5 minutes before we let out, and you will learn. Handed me this U.S. Army bugle sheet music pamphlet. He didn't hand it, though. He held it, and he said, you will learn Call to Colors and Reveille and Retreat. And you will play them, Call to Colors and Retreat, every day. And I will show you. You need to march right over here. There's three marbles in from the courtyard. It is perfect acoustically. Mike Houck is about to move on to high school, and we cannot break the tradition. You will stand there, and there will be no man-made amplification. If you stand right in that spot, all three floors of this school will hear you beautifully. That's some pressure. He said, before he handed me the pamphlet, he said, are you up for this? This is an honor. I need you to take this serious. I wanted to salute, but he was eating a homemade PB&J sandwich in wax paper and drinking from a very small government-issued chocolate milk container with a straw, and it just seemed like the wrong gesture. So Patsy Cline was playing quietly in the background, Crazy, and it felt just right. So I said, why don't we seal the deal with some push-ups? He put his sandwich down, he looked at me, he let go of the pamphlet, and he said, I'll let you off with 15, but I'm going to do the standard 25. Well, I'll tell you what, I did all 25, and I showed up 10 minutes early with my trumpet behind my back. I had spent the entire weekend learning those bugle calls. Mike Houck shows up about 10 seconds before we're ready to play, and he says, at ease, Gaylord. The only thing you have to do is not fuck this up by playing louder than me all year. And then he goes into it. Oh, and I got to tell you, Mike Halp was, for a bully, he was all right. He was built like a brick house. And when I pointed out the irony of his stature and wearing that Commodore's brick house with the woman with the triple D's, I could not lift my shoulder for a week. But he said 2, 4, 6, 8 for flinching, motherfucker. So I could not lift that arm. I had to play the trumpet with the other hand for a week. But, you know, I did cover for him when he was making out with the new transfer student who didn't know he was a douchebag yet in the stairwell. I covered with the principal for why he wasn't there playing the horn. I made up a story about Mrs. Trout's class bringing the special needs kids in, and he was out helping with the bus. He said, "Oh, great save with story. Perfect, man." And that's when he took me in as his, like, I still got hit a lot, but he took me in as his little pet. You know, and he'd share candy with me. He would introduce me to his friends with mildly racist, homophobic nicknames for me. It was really, but the tone in his voice let you know, I was all right. And he would unsuccessfully ask women to show us, me specifically, their boobs, because I had not seen one in the wild yet. This was true, but it was really horrendous to have that broadcast on a daily basis. Last day of school. I feel like I'm inheriting a vast empire. Mike is on the way out. Sam Carolla has been brought on as my wingman for the last week. He's playing, learning the tunes. The three of us are standing there. Mike says, "It's hit the road, Jack, or I hit you hard in the face." And in those 10 seconds before I could decide whether to play retreat or hit the road, Jack, it all flashed. The push-ups with Crosby, the honor pledge. And then I thought, as Sam looked at me, "What are we doing here, brother?" I thought of Mr. Crosby doing those pull-ups in front of the entire school every day at recess, saying his big fuck you to the universe. And I turned to Mike and I said, "Oh, we'll play your song, but we'll play it louder than you, you shitty high schooler." Oh, Mike laughed so hard he never even played a note. Sam and I blew that tune out, and when the school roared and cheered, I knew it wasn't for us, but I took it that way anyway. And as I rolled my bike home, the same bike that Mike House used to throw stuff at me when he drove by with his friends. But after we became kind of pseudo-bully friends, he wouldn't throw liquid or gum, and he'd keep it below the head. So as I pulled along my bike, at the stoplight, there's Jim Crosby. He looks over, he's got a trombone in the storage area. I could just roll backwards a little and he couldn't follow me in that Peugeot car. By the way, you know what you call a broken Peugeot? It's just a Peugeot, really. I sat there, held my ground, I looked over at Mr. Crosby and he said, "Peugeot." I looked over, and Crosby looked at me, and he said, "Halp was never serious about anything, eh?" This is a man who could tell the tone and timbre of any one of his students' instruments, how many were playing from 100 miles away. So he gave me a pass. And he had told the class right before he dismissed him that day that he was in an American brass quintet that was hired to roam the malls that summer. And I think all of my friends took it as fair warning. But I thought I might just check it out that summer. And I said, "Have a good one, Mr. Crosby." I wrote that story over the weekend. And when I posted it today, the draft, one of my friends from Florida emailed back and said, "You know, Jim died Saturday night." and I'm not going to get all new age and woo-woo on you, but goddamn, I was channeling that man's spirit on a Saturday night when he was leaving the planet, is what I like to believe. And I want to read you one last thing as kind of a send-off to Jim. And then maybe I'll play a little When the Saints Go Marching In. This is called Why I Ride. I ride for the girl who didn't get away. I ride for a few more good ideas that did. I ride to get the mud out of my hair. I ride to get the mud in my hair and out of my heart. And because I know everybody cheats, but maybe not all the time. I ride for the 12-year-old girl murdered for bike parts by two boys she met on the internet. I ride to feel the world outside my head, the one that makes my bones hum and ache and glow and keep my hopes in place. I ride because I can't sing like it sounds inside my head. I ride to feel my son's cheek against my back, the vibrations of his laughter as we coast through showers of October leaves. And I ride to give myself the strength to grieve. Thanks, Jim. And thank you guys tonight.
Thanks again to Joker Maskey. Much appreciated.
And one last thing. Rob Zemeckis and Chuck Roseberry bought Metal Cowboy. That's the guy who made Forrest Gump and Castaway and all that other good shit. I thought it was the Nigerian bankers emailing me, so I didn't check the email for a couple days. But they bought it, and we are far along in a project that right now the guy who made Mad Men is working on the possibility of taking this on. They're talking with actors. It's a pretty cool thing. Not because, listen, I'm at the point in my life, I downsized, we live in a small place in Selwood, I ride my bike 24/7, got rid of one of our two cars, I parked the other thing on the, I put the key around my wife's chest, who bikes to school. So I don't give a shit about, you know, if I had $1 million. But what I do care about is that we could have on mainstream premium cable a story that centers around a cyclist in every episode and the bike as that literal and metaphoric device to set you free.
And we could use some of that, right?
Oh, please. We're at 2:02 right
yeah.
now.
Yeah.
And not to get all jaundiced on you, but I'm excited about it. And you know, it might be a lot of fun. And we're going to shoot it in Portland. That's the plan.
Fabulous.
So,
congratulations.
So, cameos. Thanks, you guys.
Definitely. And, of course, he has books for sale. We're not getting anything off it. It all goes to Camp Creative, which
$10 my yes. summer camp we do with the Portland Public Schools gets the money. And I have two more books coming out, A Guide to Falling Down in Public and The Wandering Years. So look for those.
That's it. All right, we're going to wrap this thing up. But first, Aaron, can you summarize? Is it possible to summarize what we learned tonight?
I'll do what I can.
All right.
First off, someone bought me a beer. Thank you very much.
It's much appreciated.
However,
Side
I
note.
Don't drink alcohol. So
the sentiment is there.
I appreciate the sentiment. I will give this to a deserving person.
There we go.
Later.
Fabulous.
Oh, yeah, we should probably give that to Lillian or Parecki over there. Thank you so much again for working the internet.
Seriously, these guys have been manning the internet for us all night long. Give them a hand. Buy them a beer. Seriously, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lillian. Thank you, Aaron. Thank you, internet. So what did we learn today? Well, one thing we learned is even though your 50th anniversary might be gold, and your 75th wedding anniversary might be diamond.
Oh,
apparently,
wait.
Your first year anniversary is urine.
Apparently.
That is after the cheap wine. We learned that Dan Christensen, even though he doesn't look like he's ever been on a bike, has had many bike adventures. Bikes have touched Dan in many ways, and I noticed he left that open to interpretation.
They're touching us through him. That's for sure.
Dan says, "Give us rain!" Exclamation mark. Dan also says, "When I drive a bus, I move people. But when I'm on a bike, people move me."
What did we learn from Sarah?
What did we learn from Sarah? We learned that your tax stimulus plan should be made for a bike purchase.
That's right. I think that was noted on the internet by somebody. Good call.
Yeah, everybody loved that, by the way, Sarah. Time slows down on a bike. Everything is okay on the back of Sarah's bike. When you bike, you're independent, powerful, but you still need to carry things. I learned one of the best pickup lines I could ever use on a bike.
Do tell.
Can you pick me up on the back of your bike?
Yeah, I like that.
Powerless, maybe. No. With her bike, Sarah still has her power. What did we learn from Joe Kermaski? We learned...
So much.
So much. What have we learned from Joe Kermaski? Well, one thing we learned is that riding up to Brock and Adele's house is very similar to riding through Copper Canyon on a Jeep with people with machine guns.
Dicey future.
We learned we should be uncomfortable, take risks, live dangerously, and have fun. We also learned that saying that you biked through north of Italy makes you sound like an asshole.
So look out. Just keep it to yourself.
You also cannot sweat at 1.5 miles an hour. However, you might get a salute from a veteran. We also learned that when faced with a mob, either jubilant or vicious, if you give them the truth or the show, they will choose the show every time. We also learned that a blanket of guilt always ends with a river of peace. We also learned that the metal cowboy married way above his station.
Haven't we all? I mean, those of us who have married.
Thanks, Brad.
Yeah.
Just rub that in.
I didn't mean to rub it in.
We learned he rides to get mud in his hair and out of his heart. That's a great line, by the way. I'm totally stealing that. you should do that. We also learned that soon we're going to have a bike-centered story on regular television.
Fabulous. All right, folks. Just before we go, I wanted to let you know, we are not supported by advertisers. We do this because we love you. We love bicycles. So if you're interested in contributing, you can donate to us. We are on the internet, thesprocketpodcast.com, and we have a Patreon donation link right there for you. So whether or not you donate, we love you all. We love you, Portland. We love you, internet. We love you...
Everybody.
Yeah, everybody. Seriously. So don't go without getting a hug. And
from Brock.
Don't hug him. Hug me. And we got a couple of stickers. So,
straight edge for hugs?
Yes.
He's pretty straight edge. He's too straight edge for hugs. But let's just quickly, before we roll the credits, thanks again to VeloCult. Let's give a hand to everybody as I announce these people. Thanks to VeloCult. Thanks to Eric Iverson and the Grilled by Bike crew. Thanks to Aaron Parecki and Lillian Karabek. Thanks to Dan Christensen, Sarah Gilbert, Joe Kermaski, and all of our donors. Stick around for saxophonist and political activist Gilad Atzman at 9. Thank you. That's like really soon. Thank you and good night. All right, let's roll those credits.
Shit. Let's roll those credits. Let's, God,
yeah,
dang
exactly.
It.
I really can't play this.
Perfect. Find us on the internet at thesprocketpodcast.com. Send feedback about the program via email, thesprocketpodcast@gmail.com. Call or text us at 503-847-9774. Twitter to at Sprocket Podcast. Thanks to Ryan J. Lane for our theme music. Thanks to Hurt Bird for our headline sounder. Thanks to Joe Kermaski for our exiting music. Thanks to our sustaining donors, Logan Smith, Shadowfoot, Katrina Mellengard, Roger Grigsby, Wayne Norman, Doug Robertson, Ethan Georgie, Justin Martin, Eric Iverson, Cameron Lean, Richard Wazinski, Tim Mooney, Orange and Purple, Glenn Kubish, Matt Kelly, and Jim Gooden. Thank you all for being here.
Have a great night. Have a few more beers and tip your server. Take care. There are people on the internet. Is it working yet? Yeah. Okay. Tell you what, Joe, I'm going to give you this one.
Oh, now it's working.
Here we are. I'm going to do a few stories tonight, and I don't think this cord will stretch, and that's unfortunate because I'm married to an Italian, so I'm honorary, and I talk with my hands. And let's see if this one will work. Maybe this come back to life. Frozen caveman Laura, you just handed me a cable. Oh, I feel violated. All right, I think we're good. I can move around like Mick.
A Sprocket Studios production.